Today is May 5th, 2017. I'm Philip Alexiou, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up on the program, North Korea threatens to go after U.S. and South Korean intelligence operatives. President Trump smooths relations with Australia's prime minister at a World War II battle anniversary. How might the world respond after the French presidential election on Sunday? And on this Friday, we go to dinner with Golden Globe winner Richard Gere and Laura Linney.
How much do you know?
How much do you know?
He's going to turn us in, man. He's going to turn us in. I know.
It's all on today's International Edition. Well, another day, another threat from North Korea, this time the country threatening to launch what it calls an anti-terrorist attack against U.S. and South Korean intelligence agencies because the North accuses them of plotting to kill leader Kim Jong-un. The statement coming from North Korea's official Korean Central News Agency says that the CIA and South Korea conspired to use a biochemical substance to take out its leader. Thus, Korean-style anti-terrorist attack will be commenced from this moment to sweep away the intelligence and the plot-breeding organizations of the U.S. imperialists and the puppet clique, so it says. So with more on this story, I'm joined in the studio with VOA's Steve Miller. So interesting allegations coming from the North today.
Very
Steve,
interesting.
What can you tell us about what's going on over there?
Well, unfortunately, North Korea has not released a lot of details about this alleged activity. The Republic of Korea, Seoul, as well as Washington here in the United States, haven't responded to this as well. But this is what North Korea is saying. They're saying that the United States and South Korea have bribed and blackmailed a North Korean working in the Russian wilderness, a lumberjack, some of being reported, to carry out an attack against Kim Jong-un on April 15th, the Day of the Sun, one of the most important holidays in North Korea, that this individual was supposed to use something called a nanopoisonous substance to get close to Kim Jong-un and carry out this attack. They also allege that this Mr. Kim from North Korea had multiple contacts with South Korean intelligence over the years, and that he may have had an accomplice by the name of Shu Guanghai of the Qingdao Nazca Trade Company, which is a real company in China that was only founded in March of this year and does deal with some chemical products. But you have to keep in mind that it's nearly impossible to get close to Kim Jong-un. Mm-hmm. And earlier today, I spoke with the Center for National Interest, Harry Kazianis, and he points out,
well, there's no evidence. I mean, there's a very interesting story. On the surface, it mildly seems potentially plausible. But I think North Korea's penchant for fiction on many things is I think, where we're going with this. I mean, look, the bottom line is that the United States is not going to conduct any sort of assassination on Kim Jong-un.
All right. So it's hard to substantiate any claims coming out of the North, obviously. But there must be a reason why the North might be coming out with a report like this, say, now.
Well, a lot of analysts are speculating as to what is the motive of Kim Jong-un and Pyongyang behind this. Now, this document that was posted on the North Korean Central News Agency site, the KCNI site, came hours after the U.S. House of Representatives voted to expand sanctions, and which could ultimately lead to North Korea being listed once more as a sponsor of state terrorism. It also could be construed to be a possible attempt to dissuade the United States from carrying out preemptive strikes against military assets in North Korea. It also could be geared towards the domestic audience as a way for Kim Jong-un to put people on notice that he's going to either conduct a purge or to tighten up control. And you also have to keep in mind that South Korea is also in the process of electing its next president. It's early voting time right now. The official election is on May 9th. But in my conversation with Kazianis, he also brought up a very important point.
I also think, too, North Korea is very slick about trying to keep itself in the media cycle. You know, you just think back in history, they're always trying to make sure that they're at the head of every news site's front page. It's like the lead story. I've always felt like any time that they sort of go off the front page, they come up with some, you know, crazy idea or some new crisis to get themselves right in the headlines.
So, of course, you know, we had this this crisis back in February when his half-brother was killed by these two Asian women, as it's alleged, by with this nerve agent gas. And so he's sort of coming out with this idea that maybe somebody's trying to do the same thing to him.
Correct. I mean, that is one of the allegations. A lot of the analysts point to that. But there are possibly other motives that North Korea could be using as well, because they have said they are going to conduct a sixth nuclear test at any time. There has been satellite imagery to confirm that there's activity at Pyongyang-ri. There also could be looking to carry out an intercontinental ballistic missile test in the near future as well, and are setting this up as some sort of justification for that.
All right. VOA's Steve Miller. Thanks a lot, Steve.
My pleasure.
Always having him in here for Asia expertise. All right, I'm Philip Alexiou. This is International Edition. On to our master of the hour, Andrew Palcheski, who has been following our social media line, right? Trend line.
And, yeah, always following the trend
line. I haven't had a chance to even talk to you today. You've been so busy.
It's going
to
be a surprise.
We've been running around here. So what have we got now? What's on tap today? What's trending on the trend line?
Well, it's two stories that have been trending all throughout today, including one that started even yesterday. The passage of the American Health Care Act by the House of Representatives, the narrow passage of that bill, a big victory for Republicans, a defeat for supporters of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. A lot of reaction on social media to the passing of that bill. We saw protesters shouting shame, shame at the GOP representatives as they were leaving the House. We also saw some reports of beer being rolled into the Capitol, possibly for a celebration over the passage of the bill.
That's a good thing.
They said that the beer wasn't for the Republican conference. It was for another meeting, but there was an assumption that maybe they were celebrating that. Now, that being said, the bill has gotten through the House. It has to still go through the Senate and then get to President Trump's desk. So a little early, some are saying, for the celebrations, but they're celebrating getting at least for this part through the House of Representatives.
Well, and it probably follows Donald Trump's modus, the way he likes to do things. I mean, if something good happens, he's going to want to just promote it as best he can, because he's going to be smashed by the other side one way or the other.
Absolutely. And that's what we saw the Republican representatives going to the White House yesterday and having a big press conference with President Trump. Now, that being said, a few hours after that, President Trump meeting with the Australian Prime Minister and says that Australia's healthcare system is better than the American healthcare system. The Australians, of course, have a single-payer healthcare system. So a lot of people laughing at that, saying, you just passed this bill to undo a single-payer healthcare system, or they attempted a single-payer healthcare system, and now you're praising the Australian single-payer healthcare system. So a lot of jokes at President Trump's expense about that last night. Some, though, trying to justify, saying, well, Australia's healthcare system is kind of a public-private partnership, so we shouldn't be so quick to judge. But not a great moment, maybe.
Of course, well, the Australian Prime Minister is in town. I don't know. Maybe he's trying to smooth. I don't know. But now, and that's what's going on. Is that anything else? Those the hot topics?
Well, those are the hot topics. The other hot topic, Cinco de Mayo, of course.
Oh, that's right. 5th, yes. Yep.
It's commemorating the Mexican Army's victory over the French at the Battle of Puebla, not Mexican Independence Day, as many people incorrectly believe. A lot of talk about that on social media, with people maybe misappropriating the date, misappropriating some of the cultural elements of Mexico. But a lot of people going out having Mexican food, having margaritas tonight, enjoying that. And a lot of people sharing a tweet from Donald Trump May 5th of last year, where he is pictured eating a taco bowl and says, I love Hispanics. We have the best food here in Trump Tower. A lot of people saying that was offensive then. It's offensive now. There you go.
I don't know. Well, are you going to be celebrating Cinco de Mayo today?
I think I will be going out and getting some Mexican food, of which there is a lot of good Mexican restaurants around here, around our Voice of America headquarters. So I will do that to do a little
And are we
going to
see a little Facebook shot of you put out there as well?
It's quite possible.
So you're going to follow hours, Donald Trump's you're going to do what he did last year, right?
So maybe not then. Maybe I won't be putting that on Facebook.
All right, Andrew Palcheski, thanks a lot. Always a lot of fun having you in here.
Yeah, thank you.
This is International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, India's Supreme Court upholding the death penalty for four in the brutal 2012 gang rape. A U.S. service member is killed in Somalia. The Republicans' tough health care fight moves to the Senate. And Russia saying no U.S. coalition jets are allowed in Syrian de-escalation zones. And as we said, today is Cinco de Mayo. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. You're listening to International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump meeting with Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull in an effort to smooth relations has started off rocky after a dispute over immigrants. In a phone call in February, Trump protested the agreement that his predecessor Barack Obama made with Australia to resettle about 1,200 mostly Muslim refugees, but has since softened his stance. The meeting, taking place late Thursday before a ceremony commemorating the 75th anniversary of the Battle of the Coral Sea. In that World War II battle, the United States and Australia together fought the Japanese Navy in the Pacific Ocean. VOA's Lattice Hope reports.
The U.S. and Australian leaders met on board the aircraft carrier Intrepid, one of the vessels that participated in the 1942 Battle of the Coral Sea. Trump and Turnbull both praised the U.S.-Australian alliance that ultimately led to weakening of the Japanese naval forces in the South Pacific.
I'll be speaking about the Battle of the Coral Sea tonight. That was some battle. That was a very important battle for both of us.
It was.
We did it together.
We did. It saved Australia, and it was the turning point in the war.
Trump arrived on his first official visit to New York in a good mood after his updated health care plan, designed to replace the Affordable Care Act, passed in the House of Representatives. His triumph was somewhat marred by the presence of demonstrators awaiting his arrival to protest various causes. His effort to dismantle the so-called Obamacare was among the leading ones. Demonstrators also expressed discontent with the administration's stance on climate change, Trump's remarks about women, and his opulent lifestyle, which many see as a lack of interest in helping ordinary Americans.
We thought it was important. Our sort of performance art piece is basically how the oligarchs are taking over.
All three dislike and are embarrassed by Donald Trump. His ignorance, his prejudice, his stupidity, and his hatred of women.
A U.S. Navy veteran told VOA he thought Trump was dangerous.
Our country's on a terrible path. It's on a path to destruction. And to think this man, who really has no self-control, can't think straight, can't speak, has his finger on the red button. You know, he has two red buttons. One red button to get him a Diet Coke, and the other red button is to blow up the world.
Protesters marched from central New York to the location of the Intrepid, which is now a maritime museum. Zlatica Hope, VOA News, Washington.
Well, round two of France's presidential election is Sunday, and the choices are either Marine Le Pen, or who is a far-right populist, or Emmanuel Macron, who is seen as a moderate. Now, the outcome of Sunday's presidential runoff hinges on the millions of voters, some repelled by both candidates, who must make a choice whether to hand Macron his expected victory or stay home and risk handing Le Pen a surprise win. Observers say that the choice will ripple across Europe's borders through global financial markets, on the battlefields of Syria and Ukraine, and around the halls of the UN diplomacy. International Edition's Lori London talks with Desmond Dynan, a professor of European public policy at George Mason University, about why this election has implications far beyond the borders of France.
Because the contest in France is between a populist, Marine Le Pen, and a globalist, Emmanuel Macron. And that mirrors the division which seems to be emerging globally. For instance, we had a similar contest in the United States not so long ago, and of course in the United Kingdom, the referendum on Brexit. So this is very much a bellwether of the direction in which global politics are moving. It's even more important for Europe because France is so central to the European project. And by that, I mean the project of European economic and political integration. It's one thing for the United Kingdom to decide to leave the European Union. But if France were to be led by a President Le Pen, who is, to say the least, equivocal about the European Union, who thinks that France should withdraw from the euro and have a referendum on whether to remain in the European Union, I think it could possibly be the death knell of the European Union itself.
It looks like Macron has taken a lead in the polls. Maybe not a huge lead, but a lead. How accurate are the polls normally in that part of the world?
They are more accurate than they were in the UK when it came to the Brexit referendum and the United States when it came to the presidential referendum. And the polls quite accurately reflected the outcome of the first round of polling in the of voting, that is, in the French presidential election. The polls predicted quite accurately that Macron and Le Pen would be in the second round. The two leaders from the first round contest the second round against each other, and they quite accurately predicted the percentage of votes that each candidate would receive. And so I think it's fair to say that the polls are accurate, and they are predicting that Macron will win, and I think he will win. From Le Pen's point of view, let me put it like this. Macron is predicted to win by double digits, perhaps by a 20% lead, and he may do so. But if he wins by anything less than that, Le Pen can claim something of a moral victory. Of course, she will not have won the presidential election, but at least she can claim that the margin was smaller than the polls predicted. But on the other hand, as I said, the polls so far have been accurate. They are predicting about a 20% margin for Macron. The outcome might be slimmer margin than that, but I think it's pretty fair to say that Macron is going to win.
It's a pretty contentious race, very similar in some ways to what we saw here in the United States between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. And there was a recent debate that I know you watched. What was your ultimate takeaway from that?
That's Lori London speaking with Desmond Dynan, who is a professor of European public policy at George Mason University. It is 21 minutes past the hour. Well, listen, how far would you go to protect your children? What if they had done something horrible and other people have been hurt? Now, these are some of the questions that come up in a new movie starring Golden Globe winner Richard Gere and Laura Linney, The Dinner. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the thriller revolves around choices and their consequences for two brothers.
So what's the subject at hand?
You know what it is.
It's about the boys.
How much do you know?
How much do you know?
He's gonna turn us in. He's gonna turn us in, I know.
These boys have committed a horrific crime.
Stan Lohman is a popular congressman running for governor. He invites his troubled younger brother Paul and his wife Claire to join him and his wife for dinner at an expensive restaurant. Stan, played by Richard Gere, and Paul, played by Oscar nominee Steve Coogan, have been estranged for years, but their sons are best friends. However, the two teenaged boys have committed a terrible crime that might never be found out. The Dinner is intended to decide what to do about that. Richard Gere says the film looks at the nuances of life. What is the right thing to do, and who defines what's right and wrong, especially when several people have legitimate arguments?
All of them are defensible, and all of them are understandable. And depending on causes and conditions and circumstances, we each could follow any one of those arguments. And that's our world today. This is a world of subtle mental and emotional processes. Unlike the president we have right now, the gray area is where we actually live. So there's no right and wrong in almost any situation in our lives.
The film is based on a novel by Herman Koch. Director Oren Moverman, who also wrote and directed Time Out of Mind, Rampart, and The Messenger, wrote the screenplay. He says The Dinner wrestles with what it means to be human.
I think there's a fundamental question that's being asked in the world that we live in right now, and with the technology that we have, what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to acknowledge the humanity of others? And that's really what the, you know, conversation that's coming out of this movie is about.
Rebecca Hall plays Gere's second wife, Caitlin, who is doing her best to be a mother to Gere's three children, none of which is hers. Hall says the movie shows how family dramas can have far-reaching consequences.
They're all essentially horrible people and good people at the same time. And I think that gray area is challenging to us because we all want to exist in our bubbles and assume that the people outside the bubbles are the ones who are doing the wrong thing. So to present a story that challenges your sense of black and white, right and wrong, I think is important.
Oscar nominee Laura Linney plays Claire, the wife of retired schoolteacher Paul Lohman and the mother of one of the teenaged boys. Linney says she doesn't know how she would react under similar circumstances.
I hope I would know how I would behave. I would love to say that I would take what I feel is the ethical way to go. But I think until you're actually in that situation, I don't know what primal desire comes through. I don't think I'm a Claire, but I'm sure there's a little bit of Claire in all of us, as there is, hopefully, you know, a little bit of Richard's character in all of us as well.
The dinner also stars Oscar nominee Chloe Sevigny as Barbara Loman, Stan's ex-wife, and the mother of his children. The film is playing at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York and is set for wide release May 5th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Hey there, this is Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge. Once again, every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
You've been listening to International Edition. I'm Philip Alexia. Listen, you can find us at voanews.com, and you can find us all over the place. You can like us on Facebook. You can go to VOA Now, or you can follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Be sure to catch us at all hours of the day. Thanks for joining us, everybody. I'm Philip Alexia. We'll see you next time.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Russian government has added three more NGOs to its list of undesirables as the government's crackdown on civil society continues. The three organizations were founded or backed by Mikhail Khodorkovsky, a former Russian oil tycoon and Kremlin critic who was imprisoned for 10 years on fraud charges after a trial deemed by many international observers to be politically motivated. Khodorkovsky was pardoned in 2013 and has since lived abroad. Russia's General Prosecutor's Office banned the activities of the Open Russia Foundation, the Institute of Modern Russia, and the Open Russia Civic Movement under the 2015 Law on Undesirable Foreign Organizations, which says that groups can be prohibited from operating on Russian soil if they are seen to pose a threat to the state's constitutional order, national defense, or security. Seven U.S.-based non-governmental organizations have already been designated as undesirable under the same law: the Media Development Investment Fund, the Open Society Institute Assistance Foundation, the Open Society Foundations, the U.S.-Russia Foundation for Economic Advancement and the Rule of Law, the International Republican Institute, and its sister organization, the National Democratic Institute, as well as the National Endowment for Democracy. In deploring the latest additions, Amnesty International's Russian director, Sergei Nitikin, said, "For many years, Russian authorities have relentlessly worked to create a hostile environment for civil society. Open Russia's activities in human rights defense, its support of independent candidates running for national and local elected office, and media work were a great impediment to them. By banning the organization, the authorities intend to overcome this obstacle." U.S. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner said the United States is deeply troubled by the recent designations of the three NGOs. "We reject the notion that these and other international civil society organizations are a threat to Russia. If Russia hopes to build a strong, democratic government with a dynamic, competitive economy, it should value and support, not harass and criminalize, such independent voices." The United States again calls on Russia, Mr. Toner said, to uphold its international obligations and commitments to promote and protect human rights and fundamental freedoms, and to cease restrictions on the work of civil society organizations in Russia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.